You'll need to approve the recording at your end. It's a new security feature in there. And we are ready to go. Okay, if you can leave your cameras on, that's great, because I can see you. If not, then that's okay too. And I'll understand. I won't take it personally. Okay, so last, where are we up to? I want to use tonight to kind of bring together all the loose ends of our discussion on our discussion on this chapter, the effort of Yoav to bring Avshalom home, and why, and what is Avshalom's agenda, what is David's agenda, what are they trying to accomplish? In the end, they bring Avshalom back, but only partially pardoned, and then at the end he embraces him, and that starts and triggers the rebellion. There's a lot of different moving parts, but the centerpiece of the story has clearly been conversation with this Ishat Koit, this woman that Yoav engages to tell her story or to make up a story, either way, to David, and in doing so, convince David to embrace Avshalom, or to bring Avshalom home. And so we started to look at that conversation because more or less there's the mashal, there's the story itself, which is the brother kills brother, and it was an accident or it was a fit of passion, and then they're the only two children she has, and she's a widow, and the family's out for blood. The family wants to kill the Goel Adam, wants to redeem the supposedly to avenge the blood of the deceased brother by killing the only remaining child, thereby setting the inheritance off onto a path of broader family claim to the inheritance. And so she argues that this is all about the inheritance, right? They want to nishmida, then ashmida gamet to yoresh. They want to take the only heir that I have, and not to leave levilti liishi levilti sim liishi shem ushirita pnei adama, to leave me and my husband no name, no remnant left on the earth. In the end, David is moved by the plight, and he promises her this child's protection. At that point, she moves from the mashal to the story to what she would apply, the application, in this case, the Nimshal, which is to David, essentially to say to David, okay, well, you pardoned one son who killed his brother. You should pardon the other son who killed his brother, namely Avshalom. That more or less is what we would think is what's going on. But that's not what she does. And in her speech to David, she suddenly gets very emotional. Suddenly the coherency of her argument breaks down. And so our challenge is to put back the pieces of the puzzle. What is it that she's trying to convey in this message? And so we spoke about one half of that picture last week, namely the first two psukim. Vatomer Aisha, this is what she said. V'lama chashavta kazot alam elokim umidaber hamelach hadavar hazeh ke'ashem. Why would you think such a thing of the people of God in speaking this, pardoning my son for killing his brother? You speak as one who is, sorry about that. You speak as one who is guilty. Levilti hashiv hamelech et nidcho. Because the king does not return his own banished one. We must die. We are like water spilled on the ground. The canopy gathered up. Everybody dies. God does not favor any soul. I'm clear what that phrase here means. But let him devise a plan. Some means by which the one who is banished shall not be banished or an outcast forever. And at that point, we stopped last week and we said, more or less what she's making, the argument that she's making is the moral argument, the spiritual argument, the argument that by sending him not only out of reach, by sending him not only into exile, but by sending him to exile into a foreign land, into the embrace of his grandfather, who's the king of Eretz Geshur, into the embrace of a foreign, into the embrace of a foreign king, what that essentially does is it challenges or risks losing Avshalom forever to any kind of spiritual connection. We looked at it, we compared it to Yiftach, we compared it to Yosef, we compared it to all kinds of stories in Tanakh, where the, even David himself, and why it resonates so much with David, is that you have this, David himself had been exiled from the land when he was being chased by Shaul and had to go into Eretz Plishtim and had to pretend that he was a Gentile or that he was a Plishtim, a Philistine, and that he was loyalty, homage to their gods, etc. Very uncomfortable position to be in himself. And he certainly hears that argument. I believe that that's the moment where he decides to agree to allow Avshalom to return. However, there's two parts to his decree, if you remember. When David finally says to her, this was Yoav's, well, when she admits that this was Yoav's doing after David challenges her and says, Hayad Yoavitach, did Yoav put you up to this? He turns to Yoav and he says, okay, bring back Avshalom. Yoav goes to Eretz Geshur, he brings back Avshalom. And then, he'll go to his house, but he won't see my face. And the mystery of this whole parak revolves around that moment. Why did you bring him back if you don't want to see him? Why did you bring him back if you don't want to embrace him? Why did you bring him back if you're not going to give him a pardon? David does something very odd here. On the one hand, he acknowledges what she says, that, okay, we need to bring him back from this exile. And yet, he's going to go in at the house arrest in Yerushalayim. So this is a bit of a mystery. What I want to suggest, and I'll kind of give you the punchline of the shiur today before we start, is that this argument that she presents to David is actually not one, but two separate and distinct arguments. That she, her message here from Pasuk Yud Gimel to the end of her speech is not one theme, but two. One theme David agrees to. The other theme, or the other message, David not only disagrees, but in it he sees Avshalom's meddling. Yoav's meddling. And so that's where I wanted to pick up today. What is going on in this conversation? Where is Yoav's hand? What is this second piece of the story? And here's where it gets more complex. Because the moment she makes this argument, let him not be an outcast. If she'd stopped there, she's made a point. You pardoned my son, now take care of what you need to do for yours. Then she goes on into this very complex conversation. Viata, now, she says, Ashebati litaber al hamelach, the reason I have come to speak to the king. She's spoken very plainly up until this point. She's been very plain. But now she gets complicated. The reason I have come to speak to the king, the davar zeh, ki iruni ha'am, because the people have made me afraid. And your maidservant said, okay, so adavar anal ha'melech, so I will speak to the king. Ulai yaseh melech et dvar mato. Maybe the king will perform the request of his servant. The king will certainly hear, deliver and save his servant from the hand of the man who would come to destroy me and my son together from our inheritance in the land of God. Right here, the king is certainly going to hear my plea. And so your maidservant said, let the word of the king be for my comfort, be a source of comfort to me. The king is like an angel of God, to hear good and to discern good and evil. May Hashem, God, be with you. On the face of it, it's very hard to understand what she is talking about in this conversation. What is she addressing in this discussion? Right? She stopped here after Pasuk Dalet. Don't let him be an outcast. The emotional plea for Avshalom is so coherent, so cogent. And she starts talking about, I was afraid. So I said to the people, okay, I'll go talk to the king. Nobody else wants to talk to the king. Maybe if you have compassion for my son, after all, certainly you'll hear my plea, my son, my inheritance, my portion. Suddenly she's back to the story. Whether it's a real story or not, we don't know. But suddenly she's jumped back into that role. And then, so where is all of this going? And on top of that, the opening two statements that I said we saw before, Pasuk Gimel and Yadalad, she throws in here phrases that don't seem to resonate with the story of Avshalom's spiritual plight, where she talks about, Lama chashavta kazot am Elokim? Why would you say this about the people of God? What people of God? She's talking about either her story, which is her son, and the brother that he killed, or David's son who killed Amnon. What is this Amalekim? Where did the people enter into this conversation? And kimot namut v'chamayim anigrim artzav shelo yasef, we must all die like a water spill, like water spilled on the ground that can't be gathered up. What relevance is that? I mean, it might be true, but it's a pretty harsh statement in itself. What does it mean? And if I wanted to construct out of her words just the argument related to Avshalom's plight in exile, I could take half a Pasuk Gimel, half a Pasuk Dalet, create one phrase and be done. But she's talking about the people dying, and she's talking about the water spilled on the blood spilled on the ground. She's talking about this, back to the mashal of destroying her and her son from her inheritance. She's back to the king listening to her plea. She's back to the people who are afraid. And so I said, I will go speak to the king. And David's response to all of that is quick. Hayad Yoav Itach. Yoav put you up to this. I'm not sure we even understand what she said, and Yoav has already put her up to it. So what's going on? So I think there's two key phrases here that we need to highlight and recognize as kind of central to the puzzle that she's trying to present. One key phrase we haven't seen. There's a lot of different kind of pieces of emotional arguments here. Your maidservant and your king, and I was afraid, and I spoke about the people dying. There's a lot of different phrases here, but there's one phrase that is very rare and very poignant and pointed. And that's the end when she says in Pasuk Yud Zayin, which I think is what gives David the clarity to understand what she's addressing. Sorry, the highlight does not work. I have to go this way. Suddenly she throws into this whole conversation a phrase she hasn't used yet, namely that the king's wisdom and insight is godly in its depth, to be able to discern good and evil. That's a phrase that should jump off the page. Why? What does that phrase remind us of? There are really three points of intersection in that phrase, but let's deal with one. Lishmoa hatov ve'ara. That phrase resonate in any context? No. Well, if I said something about hatov ve'ara, what would you tell me? No.
Reminds me of Yom Kippur for Davin.
Okay, I'll buy that. Right, Tov Hara, Chol Ma'aminim. Okay, what else? What in Chumash? What in Tanakh?
Is it Gan Eden?
Yeah, I mean, the first place you see the distinction, the parallel between Tov and Ra in one phrase is the story of Gan Eden, is the Eitz HaDaat Tov V'Ra. Right? I mean, that's the kind of the immediate connotation that I would have thought of would be Lishmoa HaTov V'Ra. You're talking about change the word Lishmoa to Ladat. David is able to hear or discern Tov V'Ra. He also knows Tov V'Ra. If I said Ladat Tov V'Ra, would that help? That have resonated differently, right? David, King, Ladat Tov V'Ra. Unfortunately, Ladat Tov V'Ra as a phrase from Gan Eden doesn't resonate well because the Eitz HaDaat isn't necessarily the most positive story. But it does point me to the second moment where that phrase plays a key role. And why Lishmoa Tov V'Ra is the phrase she uses, not Ladat. Lishmoa Tov V'Ra has a slightly different connotation. What is Lishmoa Tov V'Ra? So let me take you to a couple of chapters from now. Beginning of the Book of Kings. Shlomo HaMelech. Sefer Melachim Aleph Perek Gimel. Shlomo HaMelech comes to the throne. Comes to the throne as a young boy. It's unclear how old he is. His first act as king is to get married, so he can't be too young. But on the other hand, he describes himself in this passage, in Pasuk Chet, he describes himself as in Pasuk Zayin, Vanochi Na'ar Katon. I am a young boy. How young he is a big machloket. Chazal say he's 12 because he talks about himself being a Na'ar, and on the other hand, he's getting married. Okay, I would grant that he can't be too old because. Remember, Shlomo was born after the story of Bathsheba, and maybe even after the death of Avshalom, which means that he's a young boy when he comes to the throne. It's the latter half of David's reign. But even so, I'll make him, how old could he be? 15, 17? Okay. Unclear. Let's give him, he's in his older teenage years. I'd be willing to give him that. But his first order of business is to do exactly what David commands him to do, which is to build the temple. And so the first thing he does is he goes down to Givon where the Mizbeach was. Vayelech HaMelech Givona, Mizbeach Sham, Kiyeh Bama Gdola, and there in that great high place in the Mizbeach, he's going to offer 1,000 offerings, 1,000 sacrifices, and begin the process of preparation for the building of the temple. And there he has a dream. B'Givon Nira Hashem Al Shlomo. Chalom. And in that chalom alayla, God says to him, Vayomer Elokim, Sha'al ma etten lach. Ask what it is that you would like me to give you. So if any of you ever, the course that I taught many years ago in Kohelet, we spent a good deal of time talking about this phrase. If not, don't worry about it. Eventually all things circle back. We'll deal with Kohelet another time. But just to jog the memory. God comes to Shlomo and he says, Sha'al ma'aten lach, what do you want? So now begins Shlomo's speech. Vayomer Shlomo, Ata asita im avdecha David avi chesed gadol kasher alach lefanech b'emet u'bitztaka. You showed great kindness to my father David who walked before you in righteousness and in just and in truth. Bishvat lev imach, and he was upright of heart with you, you made a promise to him and you kept that promise. What was that promise? To put a son who sits on his throne today. Open parentheses. Now that we're studying Shmuel Bet, we understand only too well how difficult it has been for David to find the appropriate person to put on his throne. To find the appropriate wife, to find the appropriate successor. He had his firstborn Amnon, and now he has Avshalom, and Avshalom's going to rebel, and then he has this Bathsheba, and Bathsheba's children keep dying, and eventually he has Shlomo. David's latter half of Sefer Shmuel Bet has been really from Perek Zion, from the moment David brought the Aron back to Yerushalayim, and he had the conflict with Michal, and he kind of separates from Michal. He's without his primary wife. Michal was supposed to be the path to the succession to the throne. Michal would have a child who would sit on his throne. It would be easy because Michal is Shaul's daughter. Now, unfortunately, his path became more complicated. So he is looking for a second, for another wife, and he ends up with Bathsheba, and Bathsheba's a more complicated story. So he has Amnon and Avshalom and Tamar, and that complicated story. The whole latter half of Sefer Shmuel has been a tumultuous effort to find somebody to sit on David's throne. So it kind of passes us by over here in this phrase that, oh, Shlomo Melech is standing there and he's praising, Titen lo ben yosheba kiso. Even when Shlomo was appointed, there was a challenge to that position, to that appointment. Adoniyahu challenged it. Adoniyahu went on a rebellion. Finally, Shlomo sighs a sigh of relief. Okay, I'm on the throne. Yata Hashem Elokai. Ata imlachta tavtacha tachat David Avi. You made me king in the seat of my father. And I am a young boy. I don't know how to go out and come in. I don't know how the art of war. Latzit v'lavo is the art of war. I don't know how to lead. I'm uninitiated, untrained. Ve'avdecha betoch amcha asher bacharta am rav asher lo yimaneh v'lo yisafer merov. Your servant, referring to himself, sits amidst an enormous people, a large people, a people that cannot be counted, a people, great multitude of in number, and I would add in parentheses that Shlomo doesn't say, but multitude of ideas, multitude of values, multitude of perspectives. Right? We are a complex, stubborn people. And this young Na'ar, this young man, after all the tumult of David's life, has been put on this throne and been untested. Says Shlomo, "Anatata l'avdecha lev shomea lishpot et amcha lahavin ben tov l'ra." Give your servant an understanding, judicial heart, to be able to judge your people, to understand, to discern tov and ra, good and evil. Who can possibly judge this enormous, great people of yours? So classically, this is understood as Shlomo's request for wisdom, chachma. And God responds to it accordingly. God pleases God and he asks him, you didn't ask for long life, you didn't ask for wealth, you didn't ask for your for warrior status against your enemies. What did you ask for? You asked for a discerning ability to judge. We call that chachma. And so God granted him, natati lecha lev chacham benavon. I'll give you that understanding heart, and I'll give you with it the wealth and the power that comes with the osher and kavod that'll come with as well, even though you didn't ask for it. Not our subject for today. That we'll deal with when we deal with Sefer Malachim. But havin lishma mishpat, discerning heart. How does Shlomo describe it? Lahavin ben tov l'ra. Lev shomea lishpot et amcha lahavin ben tov l'ra. Discerning heart to judge your people, to be able to distinguish between good and evil, right and wrong. Now I come back to David. What does she say to David? Ki kamalach alakim ken adani amelach lishmoa hatov ve'ara. What has David done here that is so extraordinary that she highlights this ability to discern between good and evil, this power of judgment, this power of mishpat that Shlomo HaMelech will highlight in his description, in his request from God? That's exactly what she says, this Ishatkuit says to David. Why? Why is that the key piece? Because that's the key piece that's missing. What David has done here has been to restore something that has been missing for too long, years. Namely, the role of the king to do what? Right, the role of the king to sit as shofet, to sit as a judge, to sit in the courts, to hear people's arguments, to discern, to decide. to say you're right and you're wrong, to protect the innocent, to pardon this son who killed his brother in order and protect him from all of the Goalei Adam, for all of those redeemers of blood who are avengers of blood, who all they want is blood, because all they want is the Yerusha. And David enters into that, says, okay, not on my watch. Nobody's going to harm him. Oh, you're going to bring the... That's a different David already. We haven't had that David in a while. But that's exactly what she says. She praises him. This is like your wisdom, like the wisdom of God, is the wisdom of an angel, is to understand, to judge, to enter into the context. If we understand that that's her conclusion, now let's go back to the beginning of the story. What is she describing in her description of the state of the Jewish people at that moment? It's almost like she's presenting to David this kind of, you know, the backwards version of the State of the Union. She's going to come to David and tell him what the world looks like. But that's exactly what she does. She holds a mirror up to him and says, this is what the world looks like right now. You want to know what the world out there looks like? David, you've been living in your palace for a little bit too long. I'll show you what the world looks like. That's what it looks like. Number one, kimot namud v'chamayim enigavim arza. Water spilled on the ground, the canopy gathered up. That's what blood of Israel is like. Mot namut. From the moment I decided to come to the king, I came to you because the people have made me afraid. What are the people afraid of? What is she afraid of? That she has to say to David, okay, I'll speak to the king. Maybe he'll do something for me. Because the perspective of the people is what? Is that David will do nothing. He didn't do anything when Amnon raped Tamar. He didn't do anything when Avshalom killed Amnon. He hasn't done anything for years because he can't. Because his moral discernment has been corrupted by the story of Bathsheba. Because his ability to be trusted with the scepter of judgment has been lost. And what you end up without that power of judgment is what? You end up with a situation where, what's the rule of the land at this moment? Yishma melech latzilut amato mikafa ish lashmid oti bet bni yachad min nachalat elokim. The king will certainly hear and deliver me from the hand of the man who wants to destroy me. The world out there looks like this, pasuk and pasuk tet zayin. Everybody's out for blood. Brother kills brother. The family wants the inheritance. The blood is in the streets. Kimaim kimot namut v'chamayim enegavim arza. The law of the jungle, might makes right. The world is in chaos. And you know why the world is in chaos? Because of exactly what it says at the end of Sefer Shoftim. What's the very last sentence of Sefer Shoftim? Sefer Shoftim, which is before we had a king. We had judges, and we had temporary judges, and the judges ruled for a period of time, and they didn't rule for other periods of time. And when there was no judge, and there was no king, and there was no leadership, what does the Navi describe? Without a king, without a judge, without control, without law and order, without a sense of good and evil, right and wrong, chaos, anarchy reigns. That's what she describes. She describes anarchy, blood in the streets. Yishma melech latzilat amato. Maybe the king will hear. The people are afraid to even talk to the king. I said, okay, I'll come to the king. Maybe he'll hear me. Maybe he'll intervene. Because the rule has been up until now that people felt they can't. There's nobody to intervene. A brother kills brother and there's blood and runs away. And Avshalom and Tamar and even David, where's David going to go? So we talked about why David can't go back to the courts, why David can't sit in the head of the court. That's part of the primary role of the king. There are two roles to the melech. Role number one is to lead the army into battle against their enemies and protect the people. Rule number two is to sit at the head of the courts. Job number two is to sit at the head of the courts and maintain law and order internally. That's the mandate. That's the job description of the king. David's hands are tied. Every time David would adjudicate or rule, or he say, okay, you're right and you're wrong, and somebody will turn to him and say, well, what made you right or wrong? And he's guilty of murder of Uriah and adultery with Bathsheba. And so nobody knows the inner conversations that he has with Natan, and the turmoil and the tumult and the tshuva that he's gone through, and the personal pain that he's gone through. Nobody sees that. They just see the externals. And the externals is that David's hands are tied. So he's been unable to function in this capacity. But that has left a void. And the void has been felt not just in the palace of Amnon, Tamar, and Avshalom. The void has been felt across the country. Yimot namut v'chamayim enigavim arza. We are dying with water spilled in the streets. And I've come to the king because Yiruni Aham, because the people have made me afraid. And nobody is standing up and nobody's talking to the king. Maybe the king will finally intervene. Maybe the king will hear my plight. Maybe the king will set justice on its course. Lishma Hatovira. And you know what? That's the argument. Now, simple question. Let's assume for the moment that's her case. There's no justice, there's no courts operating, there's anarchy, and there is might makes right, jungle law is everywhere. We need law and order. How does bringing back Avshalom solve that issue? That's the question. I understand the first argument. The first argument is, don't leave Avshalom in the hands of Melech Geshur. She says it in Pasuk Gedalet. David hears it. How does the second argument, that there's chaos in the streets and there's no law and order and we need judgment, we need judiciary, we need mishpat, we need a melech, how does bringing Avshalom back, what is she suggesting? Is she implying in this argument that you, David, should abdicate and let Avshalom take over the throne? Is that what she's arguing? I don't think so.
She can't be arguing that he should kill Avshalom.
No, for sure not. She's arguing, somehow she's arguing that this solution, well, this is what I think Yoav's hand is, right? This is where David sees and hears Yoav. Somehow in this presentation, David is hearing, or she's making the argument, that the solution lies in bringing back Avshalom. So my question is how? Robert, what were you going to? Yeah,
you partially answered my question.
Oh, sorry, it's Brian. Sorry, I didn't see you, Brian, there. Okay.
Was the last part of this woman's speech prompted by Yoav, or was this from her own heart?
Well, that's we don't know, because it doesn't say which part of this conversation was from Yoav and which part was from her. All we know is that at this point, the moment she finishes, David says to her, did Yoav put you up to this? And everything I understand about Yoav and everything we talked about Yoav last couple of weeks, I have a hard time seeing Yoav being so concerned about the spiritual legacy of Avshalom being left out there in the hands of the king of Geshur. It doesn't sound to me like a Yoav-isk kind of concern. Whereas the lack of law and order, people dying in the streets and the need to take a strong hand, that sounds to me like a little bit more of Yoav's style. I think David understood that too.
Maybe she wants Avshalom to be the king.
Bringing back Avshalom would put him on the path to being the king. Question is when? That's the key.
Maybe she means now.
Oh, so that's my question. Does she mean now? Is she suggesting to David that he abdicate? Abdication is not a concept in Jewish law. So what's she suggesting? That Avshalom come back and launch a full-scale rebellion and knock him off and take over the kingdom?
The only argument you could say that somebody could make to David's face is that he should be the next heir and be the king after David passes away.
That's what's missing. What's missing is a declared heir to the throne. The heir to the throne was Amnon, at least in the eyes of the people. Now, nobody except you, me, and the people studying this book know that David is really looking for the child of Bathsheba to sit on the throne. And unfortunately, they keep dying, and so they're not in the equation. But nobody else understands that. Everybody else sees Amnon and they see Avshalom. Those are the only two candidates. And what's missing in this whole story, says the Eshat Guit, is there's no declared heir to the throne. But without an heir to the throne, there's no continuity and there's no stability. Shaul's kingdom crumbled because he didn't have an heir to the throne. He challenged David away from him. David was his son-in-law. That's exactly what she's saying to him. There is an extraordinary angst amongst the people. There's a fear amongst the people that the kingdom of David will collapse. And there's no successor. And the successor does more than just give it a future. The successor gives it stability today. The successor isn't only about who will sit on the throne tomorrow. It's about the fact that there's a stability to the kingdom, to the government today. We know who the succession line is. There's a reason why, in the case of, for example, in the United States, when there's a threat to the government, if there's a war, if there's an attack on the White House, or if there's an attack on the president, the first thing they do is protect the vice president. Continuity in government is critical, especially when the head of the government is also the head of the armed forces and head of the protection of the country. Continuity is everything. David has been letting this situation without a declared heir to the throne go on since he rejected Michal back in chapter 6. We're now in chapter 14, and the scenario has gotten even worse. There's chaos in the streets. And the only real solution, she says, is to declare an heir to the throne. Well, who's your candidate? Who's left? The only candidate is sitting there in Eretz Geshur. So I don't know what you want to do, says Eshat Guit to David, but you have to do something. And you've got to figure out a way that there should be justice and law and order. That's an argument I can hear Yoav launch. That's David's response is extraordinary. Vayomer HaMelech, Hayat Yoav Itach B'chozot. Did Yoav put you up to this? Because that's exactly what Yoav would have said to David if Yoav would have had the open conversation with David. So in the end, I think she makes two very poignant arguments. One is an emotional, personal, spiritual argument to the plight and spiritual destiny of, or fate of Avshalom, the nidach, the one who has been outcast, and the other is a political argument. Namely, the country is in need of a successor. And both arguments point to the return of Avshalom. And David hears that Yoav has put her up to this. She says yes, recognizing that even the story may not be a true story, right? Even her personal plight may not be a true story. We don't know, but let's assume. But Avtachah Yoav Utzivani, your servant Yoav, he's put these words in my mouth. Let's assume for the moment at least the second argument. This was in order to encourage you to orchestrate the things to the conclusion. You are like an angel of God. You know, there's another interesting observation. I meant to mention this before and I forgot. So I'm going to put it in as a postscript. There's another hint to this argument of Yoav, which is the argument for succession, that she needs to point a successor. And that I'm going to just highlight quickly for you. I'll go to this is the same parak, the same speech that she offers, but with one difference. I've highlighted and enlarged one word that appears in this passage 8 times. And what she says in this passage, "V'tomer Aisha, Lama chashavta kazot al Amalekim yedaber Hamelech hadavar hazeh ki Hashem levoti yashiv Hamelech et nitcho kimot namut etc. V'yata bati ledaber al Hamelech v'tomer shivchatcha davane al Hamelech ulai yaseh Hamelech et varavto yishma Hamelech latzil et amato v'tomer shivchatcha yena dvar Adoni Hamelech leminucha Ki adoni ha-melech lishmoa tov hara. The emphasis is jumps off the page. Everything about what she says is, we need a king, but we also need a kingship. And for that, you need a successor. So here's my question. David, agree or disagree? David, agree or disagree?
Right, he agrees with request number one and disagrees with request number two.
Correct. He agrees with request number one to bring Avshalom back, disagrees with request number two. And in so doing, he enters into direct conflict with Yoav. How does that manifest? Because look what he says. Vayomer ha-melech ha-Yoav. He turns to Yoav and he says, he puts Yoav up to it. He says, okay, go and bring him back. And Yoav falls on his face, and Yoav says to the king, how wise is the king to finally listen to his servant? Oh, now I know how much favor I have found in your eyes, says Yoav to David, that you have finally decided to listen to the request that I have made. Okay? That's, you can understand what it takes for a person like Yoav to make such a declaration. So he goes to Geshur and he brings Avshalom back from Yerushalayim. Now he goes into exile. Now he goes into house arrest. Now he goes home. I don't want to see him. He will not step foot in this palace. It's astounding. On the one hand, you went all the way to Geshur to bring him back. And on the other hand, you put him under house arrest. And then we go on with this whole physical description of how tall and how handsome and how wonderful and how much of a celebrity Avshalom was and how much how popular he was and how handsome he looked and how beautiful he was. Nothing going to help. Hayeshev Avshalom b'Yerushalayim shnatayim yamim. Ufne Amelech lo ra'a. 2 years, he'll sit there. He will not see the king. If he's not seeing the king, what does that mean?
He's not going to be heir.
He is not going to be the heir to the throne, and he is not being pardoned. He's descending in exile. Committed murder, killed his brother. He's in exile. He's just not an exile in Geshur, so he's exiled here. In other words, what David does is extraordinary. David says, okay, Yishatkuit, I'll take half your argument and I'll leave the other half. One half of the argument I buy. Namely, he's an outcast. I can't leave him in Eretz Geshur. Agreed. Yoav, go bring him home. Yoav is so pleased with himself. Oh, I get to go bring him home. Then he comes back to Yerushalayim and he says, but he's not sitting on my throne. That murderer who killed his brother, who killed my son, who killed the heir to the throne, who committed treason, in addition to committing murder, he's going to sit on my throne and build what? Build a kingdom built on murder and intrigue and that's the heir to the throne he wants. That's Avshalom the Melech Yisrael. Not on my watch. Everything Yoav has done here in this parak from the very beginning. First pasuk, Vayeda Yoav ben Tzruya ki lev ha-melech al Avshalom. Yoav saw that the king pined for Avshalom. So he went and he brought the Yishatkuit. Our original reading of the text was he saw David's heart. He saw that David really wanted to reconnect with David, that David yearned for Avshalom, which is true. He might have, but he totally underestimates David. To bring him back on the argument that therefore he will be forgiven and be the heir to the throne? That's exactly what Yoav says we need. We need an heir to the throne. There's chaos in the streets. Let's bring Avshalom back. David says, no, what? So that this murdering brother can sit on my throne? Not going to happen. That's precisely the conflict. The conflict here is between David and Yoav. David's perspective is so dramatically different. He says, no, I'll bring him back. But that's also where I think you see the wisdom of the Shatkuit, It says that Yishlach Yoav Tekoava Yikach Misham Isha Chachama. We ask the question originally, what makes her so wise? It never tells us what makes her so wise. My guess is that what makes her so wise is that her ability to navigate even around Yoav. Because I don't think Yoav said anything about being an outcast and being out there in Eretz Geshur and Dovolti Yidach Men Nidach. I don't think Yoav had any of those words on his tongue. But she manages to kind of navigate through to what she really believes at the heart of this message. And she's done her set of piece and she goes home. Fascinating conversation here. This piece, this Gemara in Sanhedrin, we looked at a couple of weeks ago when we started to talk about Yoav. The Gemara makes the assertion that when Adoniyahu rebels against the appointment of Shlomo ben Batsheva, when Adoniyahu, at the beginning of the Book of Kings, launches the rebellion against the appointment of Shlomo, Yoav sides with Adoniyahu. So the Gemara here says that the Pasuk says that he sided with Adoniyahu. And he did not side with Avshalom. Vayet Yoav achrei Adoniyahu, v'achrei Avshalom lo nata. He sided with Adoniyahu. He didn't side with Avshalom. So the Gemara raises the question: why do I need to tell me in the beginning of the Book of Kings? Right. Let's go back one parak. Yoav had followed Adoniyahu, but he did not follow Avshalom. And what is he told? He's told that Adoniyahu has been killed. So the rebellion is over. But why is it relevant that he didn't follow Avshalom here? We're talking about Adoniyahu. Says the Gemara, Bikesh lintot v'lonata. Yoav wanted to follow Avshalom. In the end, he did not. My time alone, why didn't he follow Avshalom? Because David was still functioning. David was still king. David had still had his vitality. In the beginning of the Book of Kings, David is on his deathbed. So at that point, Yoav says, okay, it's safe to side with Adoniyahu. But at this point, David is still the king, so he doesn't side with Avshalom. He sides with David. Let's start from this. This is where the question we asked a couple of weeks ago. Bikesh tintot v'lanata. He wanted to side with Avshalom, but he didn't. How do we know that he wanted to side with Avshalom? Avshalom launches a full-scale treasonous rebellion against the king. That's what Yoav wanted? Treason? Full-scale rebellion? Civil war? A civil war that costs the lives of tens of thousands of Israelites? In the end, Yoav is the one who kills Avshalom in order to stop that war, in order to end that war. Because he knew full well that as long as Avshalom lives, that war will continue. Yoav wanted a side with Avshalom. I find that really extraordinary. But that's what the Gemara says. What's the answer? The answer is he didn't want to side with Avshalom for full-scale rebellion against David. What did he want to side with Avshalom for?
He wanted a clear heir to the throne.
He wanted without David a war. To declare Avshalom the successor. Finished. Declare Avshalom your successor. David, till you live and be well, till his 120, or at least till 70, because that's how old he was when he died. He should live and be well. But when he goes, he should have a clear successor defined as of now. Don't wait till you're on your deathbed, which is what ended up happening with Adoniyahu. That's what she's describing here. Mot namut. We must all die like water spilled on the ground. There's chaos in the streets without a successor. That's Yoav's argument. And Yoav wants David to do just that. Declare a successor. And if David refuses to do it, had David actually declared Avshalom his successor, Yoav would have stood up and said, okay, the crown prince, he gets all the privileges of the royal family, and now he's sitting in the head of the army. Yoav would have sided with Avshalom. But not to rebel against David, but to build the next generation of Malchut Yisrael, which would have been through Avshalom. Didn't happen. Yomer HaMelech Yisov HaBeito. Goes home. I don't want to see him. V'nai lo yireh. And in that declaration, what David said was, and maybe he got more out of the Ishar Tkuit's speech than Yoav realized, but this declaration, V'yomer HaMelech, is vintage David. That's the David we know and have grown to love and grown to hear, the understanding of what's needed on the spiritual side and politically what's astute and what's necessary and what's moral. This Avshalom has committed treason and has committed murder. I cannot put such a person on the throne of Israel. It's not moral. It's not right. That's David. House arrest. In Yerushalayim, but he cannot come back to the palace. The moment he comes back to the palace, he gathers chariots and horses, and he has a position in the army, and he has his tanks, and he has his personal guard. And the next thing you know, in the beginning of chapter 15, is he's launched a full-scale rebellion. David understands exactly who he's dealing with. This is vintage David. And this is David could outsmart, outmaneuver even a Yoav. Take something to outmaneuver Yoav. David has held Yoav at bay for the last, since coming to the throne, since the very beginning. He's held him close. He's held him in the reins. He's used him and he's allowed him to be serve the people as in the position of the chief of staff, but he's held him at bay. And the few times that he's gotten out of hand, he's tried to rein him back in. Story of Avner, we'll see it later on at the end of the parak, right? To the extent that he can. The older he gets, the weaker he gets, and the stronger Yoav gets, becomes a problem for him. But at this point in time, Yoav had wanted to side with Avshalom, but he didn't. Why? Because the moment David says, Ufanai lo yireh, what is Vayisov Avshalom HaBeto, Ufanai HaMelech lo ra'ah, what does Yoav do? What does Yoav do? Vayeshev Avshalom Yishlaim Shnatayim Yamim for 2 years. Ufnei HaMelech Lo Ra'ai, did not see the king's face for 2 years. What is Yoav doing in those 2 years?
He's instituting what David said.
Yeah, he's following David's orders, which are nobody sees Avshalom. Avshalom, hands off. To say in Israel, in Hebrew, Shmur Merchak, keep your distance. Nobody sees Avshalom. Yoav following David's argument, Yoav following David's rule, David's law, David's command, stay away from Avshalom. Yes, that's exactly what the Gemara says. Bikesh lintot, initially, the beginning of this parak, Yoav's orchestration here is all about bringing Avshalom back to be the heir to the throne. But he doesn't. He steps back. And why does he step back from it? Because lichluchit shel David kayemet, he saw the David in full capacity, in full vitality. This isn't David lying on his deathbed. This isn't everybody else orchestrating what's going to happen in his kingdom and David not having the strength to navigate it. This is David navigating. This is David hearing the Ishat Kuit and understanding her Chachma and making the right decision and bringing back Avshalom for the moral reasons, but not allowing him to take on the political reasons. And suddenly Yoav says, you know what? Okay, this isn't David after Bathsheba. This isn't David after, this is a different David. This is David with all of his vitality and strength and command. I'm not starting up with David. So we'll see. Stand aside. Let's see and watch. For 2 years. What happens after 2 years? 2 years later, it's a different story. 2 years later, Avshalom is going to convince Yoav to finally allow David to see him. Yoav will finally come to the king and convince him to bring back Avshalom. Avshalom. And Avshalom will come to the king, and he'll bow down to him, and the king will kiss Avshalom the first time since all of this happened, and in so doing, he will grant Avshalom a political pardon. Without question, David in the end capitulates, seemingly, to the request to see Avshalom and to pardon him. And the next parak will begin. Horses, chariots, 50 men running before him. Avshalom in full scale rebellion mode. Avshalom goes and stands at the gates of the court, and he says, "Anybody who has a mishpat will come should come to me, because you're not going to get a hearing in me. You're not going to get a hearing from the king." Make me the judge. And anybody who's got a riva mishpat, let him come to me and I will do justice for him. Oh, now we're in full-scale rebellion. The moment he gets that kiss from David, the moment he gets the horses and chariots and he gets his Mercedes or his royal car or horse, whatever it is, we're in full-scale rebellion. So what has David accomplished? 2 years he sends Avshalom back to house arrest for 2 years, and 2 years later he completely capitulates to Avshalom. So what have we accomplished in this parak? Understand my problem?
Well, Avshalom has had to wait 2 years, so he's had a 2 year sentence.
Okay, 2 year sentence out of a life sentence. Okay. 2 years out of life, sir, maybe. Treason and murder is a life sentence. But I think what he ends, these 2 years make a difference, but not from the perspective of Shalom's rebellion. They make a difference for a different reason. Had David done what Yoav is correct in one sense. We do need an heir to the throne. Yoav is correct in assuming the bringing of Shalom back to the palace would be equivalent to granting him a pardon. And so Yoav correctly read what eventually happens in Pasuk Lamed Gimel. He's just 2 years premature. But in those 2 years, something happens that changes the course of David's history and maybe of Jewish history. And that's what we're going to read now. Veishlach Avshalom Yoav, sitting under house arrest in this house in Yerushalayim, Avshalom sends a message to Yoav. And the message to Yoav is l'shloch ato l'melech, to send him to the king. He's sitting under house arrest. What did he bring him back for if he to sit him under house arrest? V'lo avalav o'elav. Avshalom refused to go and visit Yoav. Sorry, Yoav refused to go and visit Avshalom. Why did Yoav refuse to go and visit Avshalom? Why did he refuse to visit?
Because he was enforcing what David said.
Because to violate David's edict and go visit Avshalom would be to be guilty of
treason,
right? Disobeying a direct command of the king. So he stays away. So Avshalom sends another delegation. And he still didn't want to come. So at this point, Avshalom is getting a little desperate. So Avshalom turns to his servants. So he has a very loyal inner circle. How do I know how loyal his inner circle is, Avshalom? Who are his servants?
Aren't they the ones that killed Amnon?
Right. They're the same servants that he commanded to kill Amnon. On his word, they'll kill the king's successor. He has a very loyal group. He says, "Ruach kat yoavel yado al yadi." You know what? I see out my window next to my house. There's a field. That field, as fate would have it, belongs to Yoav. V'lasam sham sorim. He's got a field of barley. L'chu v'yitzit batzitu abesh. Go set it on fire. V'yitzitu avdei shalom et chalkat beish. So the servants of Avshalom went and they set Yoav's field ablaze. That's really, you want to get somebody's attention? Go set their field on fire.
A lot of intimidation too.
Excuse me?
A bit of intimidation too.
Intimidation and yes, 100%. Intimidation. The last person in Tanakh to set a field on fire in order to A, get somebody's attention, and B, to intimidate them, was, anybody know? Shimshon.
Was it David? Oh, I thought it was David with Abigail's husband.
No, he doesn't. Abigail stops him. Abigail stops him. But if called the Shimshon at Ishto, remember the story of Shimshon, back in Shoftim. Story of Shimshon, it begins, he has a wife, a Philistine wife, he falls in love with, a woman he falls in love with, he gets married to her, there's a 7-day celebration, this is long before Delilah, he has a 7-day celebration, and then he had a riddle, and the Philistines threatened her that if she didn't convince him to share with them the secret of the riddle, they would kill her in her father's house. And so she convinces him, and they discover the riddle, and Shimshon is very angry, and so he leaves her. And then in the beginning of chapter 15, he comes back. I want to go to my wife to the chamber. He left her leave her at the altar, as the expression goes. But her father wouldn't let her in. Let him in. The father says to Shimshon, I'm certain that you hated her. You married her in the middle of the 7 days of celebration. You left. So I gave her to somebody else, like Shaul, who gave away Michal to Palti ben Laish. Then he offers a younger sister, so marry the younger sister. Shimshon says, nothing doing. Now I'm going to do something. Whatever happens now is on their heads, not mine. He took 300 foxes. He took firebrands, torches. And he turned tail to tail. He tied the tails with the torch in the middle. He set the firebrand on the torch on fire. And he let them loose in the fields of the Plishtim. You understand that fox with a fire on his tail is going to go run rampant and rampage around the fields. He set the entire field ablaze. That's called intimidation. Debbie, you're right. It's exactly what Avshalom does to Yoav. Okay, Yoav got the message. Mayakam Yoav Yavol Avshalom. So Yoav comes to Avshalom, to his house. He says to him, What did you do to me? You set my field on fire. What was that about? I sent a message to you. I said, Bo'ena. You know what Bo'ena means? Anybody ever hear the expression Bo'ena?
Come here.
Right? That's what Israeli mothers say to their children when they're 3 years old and they want them to come. They say, Bo'ena, right? Come here. Bo'ena. Command? Yoav, Avshalom commanded Yoav to say, Bo'ena, you come here? Ve'eshlacha otcha lemelech. I was going to send you to the king. I, Avshalom, am going to send you, Yoav, to the king. Lemor. Why did you bring me from Geshur? I would have been better off there. I want to see the king's face. If I'm really guilty, let him kill me. Let him try. So Yoav, fascinatingly, Yoav goes to the king and he says to him, you know what, maybe you should call Avshalom. And the king calls Avshalom, and Avshalom bows to him and acknowledges him. And David kisses him, and everybody seems to be living happily ever after. One big kumbaya, we're all great, one big happy family. Until the beginning of the next parak, and Avshalom launches a full-scale rebellion, as predicted. So what have we accomplished? I'll tell you what we've accomplished. One thing. That had David capitulated 2 years earlier, had this pasuk Lamed Gimel happened 2 years earlier, would have spelled the end of David HaMelech as we know it. What do we accomplish?
Exactly, he knew that Yoav was loyal.
We accomplished was when the full-scale rebellion starts in Perek Tedvav, on whose side is Yoav?
David.
Yoav stays with David. Yoav is his general. Yoav is his head of his army. Yoav commands the trust of the people. So it's true Avshalom has the trust of a large people, group of people. And it's true that at the beginning of Perek Tedvav, when that rebellion starts, it will tell us that Avshalom stole the hearts of Israel because of this argument. Because he stood there at the courts and he offered an alternative that the people saw would be a better alternative, maybe. But he might have stolen the hearts of the people, but he didn't have the heart of Yoav. He did at the beginning of the parak. It was Yoav who had orchestrated the whole story. He did at the beginning of the parak. He had Yoav, he had Avshalom in his hands. By the time the story ends, and Avshalom set fire to Yoav. Yoav, you started up with Yoav. I mean, you know what kind of brains it takes to realize that the one person in David's kingdom you do not want to antagonize is Yoav? Yoav, who reached out to the king, Yoav, who hired the Isha Atkuit, Yoav, who went to Geshur to bring him back, Yoav, to whom you owe everything. You are alive and well in Yerushalayim because of Yoav. And you're going to go and antagonize Yoav, and you're going to command Yoav, and you're going to set Yoav's field ablaze and threaten Yoav? Do you know what you're dealing with? Clearly not. So what's the end result? Avshalom comes back, Avshalom launches his rebellion, and Yoav stands at David's side. And he will lead the battle against Avshalom, and he will walk with David out of Yerushalayim when David declared exile, and he will fight the war against Avshalom, and tens of thousands of Israelites will die until Yoav ends the war by killing Avshalom. All because Avshalom had the audacity and the stupidity and the lack of insight, the lack of experience, the lack of understanding to set Yoav's field ablaze. And David, did David know that was going to happen? Probably not. But David understood that you can't just let Avshalom have free reign. That hothead brother who killed his brother in a fit of passion, in a fit of anger and vengeance, not ready, he's not able, he's not capable, and he's not appropriate for the throne of Israel. And if Yoav doesn't understand it, that's Yoav's problem. David understood it. And the end of the parak only demonstrated and proved to everyone how correct David was in that assessment. And so for the question as to who the true heir will be eventually, that we will have to wait. Nonetheless, we cannot underestimate the fact that David loved Avshalom. David pined for Avshalom. David will mourn for Avshalom. The personal side of it is not to be underestimated. But on the political side, David knew exactly what Avshalom was, what he was capable of, who he was. And so he drew that line in the sand. And that's how the parak ends. All right. We will adjourn here. I hope you kind of pulled it all together and took us a couple of weeks. That's the end of Perek Yedaled. Next week, Bezrat Hashem, we start Perek Tedvav. Now the rebellion begins. Have a wonderful evening, everybody.
Okay.
Have a good night for those on the West Coast. Have a good evening. The rest of us.
Thank you, Rabbi. And a refuah shalema, Rabbi.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.